Misunderstanding Jesus and his message has a very long history. It goes right back to his first disciples, and in a way perhaps further, because much of Jesus' message was that people were already misunderstanding God, and then they went right on misunderstanding what he was saying about that. So don't beat yourself up if you realise that you haven't fully got a handle on what Jesus was on about. You're in good company. None of us have it all worked out. We're all on a journey of discovery together. And this season of Lent is a lot about the journey. And images of journeying and discovery will keep appearing throughout the season as we seek to follow Jesus on his final journey prior to his death, the journey that led to the cross. And on this journey, there will be lots of opportunities for Jesus to challenge us again, to discover what it is that is so radically and startlingly new about the news that he was announcing, and what was so radically and startlingly good about the news that he was announcing. And tonight's readings present us with some more of those opportunities. The passage that we heard from the Gospel according to Mark is one that I referred to 2 weeks ago when I was preaching about the Transfiguration, because that story was clearly linked to this one and had to be understood in light of this one. And I'm going to comment on it in a bit more detail tonight. But first I want to touch on something of how the Apostle Paul expresses some similar things in the extract that we heard from his letter to the church in Rome. Paul uses Abraham as an illustration of the point that he's trying to make about how we become the beneficiaries of God's promises. Abraham doesn't feature very prominently in much Christian thinking, but he's a very important figure in today's religious landscape because he is the common ancestor of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And the Abraham stories can therefore be very helpful in trying to find some common starting points for peaceful dialogue between the three religions. The Apostle Paul is referring to God's promise to Abraham to make him the father of many nations, and he's exploring how Abraham and any of his descendants come to be insiders to that promise, the beneficiaries of that promise. And it's clearly not about belonging to a particular nation, because Paul is emphasizing Abraham's place as the father of many nations. And it's clearly not by living in some special holy land, because although the disputes over the ownership of the holy land often trace their arguments back to Abraham, Paul is arguing that the whole idea of the holy land was just a foretaste of the whole world becoming God's domain. And it's not about following a particular religious code of behaviour or system of law either, because the law hadn't even been given yet when these promises were made to Abraham. So the promise comes before the law. Instead, says Paul, this promise is intended for absolutely everyone, and it reaches everyone who puts their trust in God and in what God promises. And even that is not some kind of belief test. It doesn't mean that there's a particular level of trust or faith that you have to measure up to. It's just that if you don't trust the gift giver, you're not likely to trust the gift enough to accept it. The man over the back fence a couple of times offered me goodwill gifts for the church in the process of our discussions, and I declined to accept those gifts because I had a fair idea how they might be used to gain leverage that was inappropriate. One has to trust the gift giver to be able to receive the gift. Now, the thing that is so radical about what Paul is saying is the way that he sets this trust or faith in contrast to law keeping. Because Paul himself and most of his hearers were raised on a very strong sense of God's promises favouring those whose behaviour conformed to a particular religious code of law, which remains an extremely widespread understanding today. Although most Christians will speak about salvation being by grace through faith alone, most of us also have some behavioural conditions that we feel are part of it somewhere along the line. Salvation is by grace through faith alone, provided you have turned away from whichever particular behaviours are the current hot potato moral evils among us. You have to stop violating this law that we hold sacred. But Paul says there now is no law, and therefore there can't be any violation. The people had imagined that God would wipe out the violators, but instead God wiped out the laws so that people could no longer be seen as violators. Now, it may not be immediately obvious how similar this is to what's going on in our gospel reading, but it may start to become clearer when we look at what Jesus calls Peter when Peter is trying to talk him out of accepting a pathway of rejection, suffering, and death. I'm sure you remember. Jesus calls Peter a Satan. Get behind me, you Satan. Now, we tend to hear that word Satan simply as a name, but it's actually a title or a job description. If you were introducing me to a visitor and you just said, "This is Nathan," that wouldn't tell them anything more than my name. But if you said, "This is the pastor," they would probably make a whole bunch more assumptions after that introduction, probably not all of them very good. But if we do hear the name Satan as more than just a name, we tend to hear it as evil. But actually, it has a more particular meaning. You will sometimes see it translated as the accuser, which is more helpful. The word actually comes from the world of law and court cases. It means the prosecutor. That is, the Satan is the one who is trying to prove the case against you and have you condemned and punished. Which is particularly illuminating if you realise that one of the names that Jesus used for the Holy Spirit is the Paraclete, which means the counsel for the defence. So perhaps now you begin to see why this relates to what Paul was saying about the law, because the Satan is trying to prove you guilty under the law and have you condemned and punished, and the Holy Spirit is the defence counsel who is standing up in your defence and presumably arguing, as Paul does, that there is now no law on which God will judge us, so there is therefore no violation of the law that can be prosecuted. Acquit the accused, Your Honour. But what's any of this law court stuff got to do with Peter? And what has it got to do with our journey of discipleship and the things that Jesus goes on to say about denying ourselves and taking up our crosses and following him? As I said 2 weeks ago, what Peter was arguing with Jesus about is what it means to be the Messiah. Not obviously a matter of accusations and legal prosecutions, but actually it is, albeit indirectly. Peter has just identified Jesus as the Messiah, God's anointed one who everyone has been waiting for. And Jesus immediately begins telling the disciples, as we heard tonight, that he must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the religious lawyers, and be killed. And it's in response to that that Peter pulls him aside and begins to rebuke him. So basically what Peter is saying is that since, as we have just agreed, you are the Messiah, God's chosen champion, you can't possibly undergo suffering, rejection, and death. That's not in the job description. And Peter has a point here, which would have been easily understood in first century Israel, because there had been quite a few wannabe messiahs over the last few decades, and suffering, rejection, and death had consistently been seen as the proof of their failure. They had mostly ended up crucified by the Romans. Therefore, they were not true messiahs. You, Jesus, are supposed to be the true Messiah, and therefore your trajectory will be entirely different from those of the failed and false messiahs. You are going to be the biggest success of all time. That's what Peter's saying. Which is pretty understandable, but success at what? Well, here's where we get back to the legal job descriptions. The true Messiah was expected to be the one who brought down God's judgment. The Messiah is supposed to be, among other things, the judge of all the earth. The Messiah is the one who finally sorts out the good from the bad, the virtuous from the wicked, the just from the unjust, and hands out God's rewards and punishments accordingly. So you can see Peter's point. True messiahs do not get tried, condemned, and executed. They try and condemn others and execute God's judgment. You're sitting in the wrong chair, Jesus. You are not the accused. You are the judge. So what does Jesus mean by labelling Peter's argument as satanic, as the act of an accuser or a prosecutor or perhaps even a grand high inquisitor? Well, what he's saying is that all this eager expectation of a judgment in which other people will be condemned and punished is actually an eagerness for something which is the Satan's game, not God's game. As the Apostle John put it, the Son came into the world not to condemn the world, but to save it. Jesus is saying that all this desire to divide people up into the good and the bad, the righteous and the unrighteous, the acceptable and the unacceptable, all that is the Satan's game, not God's game. And if we, like Peter, try and recruit Jesus back onto the old triumphant pathways of vengeance and judgment, then we're really playing the Satan's game, not God's game. And Jesus actually equates the human game with the satanic game here when he says, "Get behind me, you Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." A mind set on the usual human things is the mind of a Satan. Because you see, the game of accusation and condemnation is one that we humans get ourselves tangled up in all the time. It is our normal way of relating to others. We divide everyone up. We label our people as good and other people as bad. Our people as saved and beloved by God and other people as lost and condemned by God. And we constantly reinforce our belief in our own goodness and our own place in God's promises by comparing ourselves to others who are so obviously far less worthy than us. It's the normal human way of reinforcing our sense of identity and belonging in a community. We are united to one another in our opposition to them and their evil ways. But when we do that, the Apostle Paul accuses us of trying to reinstate the law as the means of becoming acceptable to God and thus making faith null and the promise void. And Jesus just says, "Get behind me, you Satan, for you're setting your mind not on divine things, but human things." So Jesus goes on to describe what it means to follow him as denying ourselves, taking up our cross and following him. "Cling to your life and control of your life and you'll lose it," he says. "But let go of it and you'll find life to the full." And can you see how, in light of what he has just been saying to Peter, that means that we need to give up trying to be the winners, to be the successful ones, the ones who get to stand proudly alongside the judge and the prosecutor when others are being condemned to death. We have to give up what looks to all the world like the desirable place for good, successful, religious people. We have to give up that place. And by refusing to side with the powers of prosecution, risk becoming the accused ourselves, the rejected ones, the suffering ones, the ones condemned to carry a cross into the place of shame and death. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. It is what it is. If, like Jesus, you stop playing the morally superior, identify with the righteous and condemn the others game, you will very likely be regarded as going soft on sin or giving comfort to terrorists and enemies, or even just as odd and un-Australian. And you will find that people who previously welcomed you as one of us look at you with suspicion and keep their distance. You've stopped playing the compulsory game, the us and them game, the human game, the satanic game. In short, you will have taken sides with the one that knew his journey into the holy city would lead to his rejection, suffering, and death. And if you take sides with him and continue to follow him into the valley of death on this journey that we recommit ourselves to each Lent, you may indeed find yourselves as the insiders to God's promises, as those who emerge from the valley of death, still following Jesus, into the promised land of resurrection life and the wide open spaces of God's limitless love.